You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, in other words, The Future of the Corporation, by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the section, A Vision Without Execution is an Hallucination. Deutsche Bank's Rolf Brewer is betting on the internet, but notes the inherent gamble in how far he can go. I met with Brewer, who has worked in the bank since 1956 in New York, not long after the acquisition he engineered of Bankers Trust, chairman and CEO since 1997. He had been the force behind Deutsche Bank's transformation from a plodding commercial bank to a top investment bank. He represents the group of European executives who, contrary to the traditions on the continent, are leading proponents of a business culture that gives increasing priority to shareholders. When I came into his office, he greeted me with the same personal grace as if I were entering his home. He didn't strike me as a European titan astride one of the world's oldest and largest global financial institutions. As in my meetings with many of the CEOs I interviewed, I was taken aback by the lack of pomp, or for that matter, staff. There was a low-key solidariness to the moment that belied my expectations. Brewer's acquisition of Bankers Trust was itself a big bet. In 1989, Deutsche Bank tried to move into the fast lane of investment banking by buying the British firm of Morgan Grenfell. But the experiment floundered on cultural differences, relating not just to nationality, but also to business style. It was a huge gamble for Brewer to try again with Bankers Trust, a bigger, brasher American bank known for its appetite for risk. Brewer told me Deutsche Bank had learned its lessons from a debacle with the British, the trick being to swallow the new firm as quickly and completely as possible. Quote, "There is no longer a Bankers Trust," he said, "only a Deutsche Bank." The post-merger integration was going well, he said, and the cultural risks that so many experts had warned him against had proved vastly overrated. Quote, "But how we approach e-commerce, that is the big challenge. The real question is the behavior of our customers. In 5 or 10 years' time, will they want to have the opportunity to visit their banker person to person, or will that be a thing of the past? If it's all going to be online, then the bank has far too many people on board, far too much real estate all over the place, and we have to get rid of that as soon as possible. On the other hand, if we go too far with e-commerce, then we would lose our customers and market position." Brewer said that the decision of where the balance would be weighs heavily on him all the time. Not long after our meeting, Brewer announced a proposed merger with Germany's Deutsche Bank. A major objective of his deal was to rationalize the bricks and mortar retail banking industry in Germany, which had become far too large and inefficient. Brewer made it clear to the public that one of his priorities was to enhance Deutsche Bank's global investment banking presence by merging Dresdner's and his operations into one major powerhouse. It was a big risk for Deutsche Bank, a very conservative German institution. Shortly after the announcement of the deal was aborted, causing acute embarrassment for all the parties, especially Brewer. Michael Dell is also taking risks, but in his mind, the issue isn't technology or markets. It's the rapid scaling up of his business. If the real risks relate to infrastructure, how fast you can build a company, he said. This last year, for example, we added $8 billion in revenue and 14,000 people in 6 new plants. There is a risk when you're growing that fast, and it's a real challenge to do it right. Global strategies can also be a big bet, as Roger Enrico of PepsiCo admits. We met at PepsiCo's headquarters in Purchase, New York, a large estate surrounded by beautiful gardens. Waiting for the meeting to begin, I remember staring out the window and watching someone mow the lawn ever so slowly and carefully and wondering whether, in the middle of a global business maelstrom in which customer product companies like Pepsi found themselves, these calm surroundings were an advantage or an impediment. Enrico's guy next door image is at odds with his history as the architect of a far-reaching restructuring of PepsiCo, which began in 1996 when he sold off its extensive food stores and focused the company on beverages and snacks. Two of the big bets we are making are on China and India, he told me. Two markets with over 2 billion people. In China, for example, we think there is a huge market for our products. But it could just as easily happen the other way, and a big indigenous company could become enormously popular there and seriously challenge us. As large as the markets were, however, his company's investments were small relative to overall operations. It's better to invest at a relatively moderate rate for 20 years than to try to invest at a huge rate that can't be sustained, he said. Because success takes a long time to come. James Wolfensohn of the World Bank is making some bold and controversial moves as well. He took over the world's largest development bank in 1995 in the middle of heated controversy over its actual role. Should it be financing government projects or the private sector in developing countries, for example? Also, questioning its effectiveness, did its investments really help poor people or was it hurting them? Since then, he has forced many changes on the bank's structure and mission. His passion about the work first became evident to me a year later when he came to Yale to speak to students. Among the many stories he told our students was about one visiting the poor town outside of Rio de Janeiro, where the World Bank had helped finance the transformation of the local water utility from government to private community ownership. Before that, water had been free. Now residents received bills. A distraught peasant approached him, waving her bill in his face and speaking rapidly in Portuguese. Wolfensohn was chestfallen, thinking she was trying to tell him how poor the commercialization of water had made her. His translator corrected the impression. Quote, "This woman is showing you her name," he said. "She's saying that it's the first time she's ever been officially written out. She's saying that when she pays this bill, she can take the receipt to a local bank and get credit for the first time in her life." Wolfensohn described the lump in his throat as he realized what she was saying. "The biggest single bet I was making is that the World Bank as one player in the whole economic development field, can have a meaningful and measurable influence on what happens on our planet, he told me in our interview. Instead of just focusing on individual projects or on policy advice in particular sectors like health or environment, what I am trying to do now is move the bank to take a comprehensive approach to economic development, not just within countries, but internationally. We're attempting to do this by understanding, analyzing, and providing advice on how all the pieces of the development puzzle fit together or don't. What Wolfensohn wants is to organize a wide array of economic development institutions that do not now coordinate their efforts. The upside is not just a much more powerful role for his institution, but also a more rational approach to helping developing nations progress. The downside is that the World Bank is undertaking a mission which is so broad and so difficult that it would be seen as ineffective and the risks losing its existing support from Washington and other governments. It has accumulated many critics for just these specific reasons. CEOs have to make big bets, but how to take educated risks is the real question. A lot comes down to instinct, of course, especially since information is never complete and terrain is unstable. The ability to take calculated gambles and still sleep at night often requires surrounding yourself with highly talented people and being able to rely on their judgment to supplement your own. Still another important attribute is we have a wide range of relationships outside of the company, a broad intelligence network to provide a context, an early warning system, and a reality check. Some appear to relish the industry conference circuit, which has grown enormously in the past few years. Some are active in business associations and government-supported commissions and task forces that draw on corporate executives. Many are are on one another's corporate boards. These kinds of activities will become increasingly essential in the years ahead. Of course, the big constraint, a theme throughout the CEO's life, is having enough time to talk to people outside of the company and the industry and also run a complex global operation at the same time. The cases of three CEOs who resigned under pressure since my interview with them illustrate what happens when vision and execution don't quite come together. Richard Uber was, until February 2000, the chairman, president, and CEO of Aetna, a position he held for less than three tumultuous years. He previously had served on Aetna's vice chairman for finance and held top executive positions at Citibank, Chase, Continental Bank, and the investment bank of Wasserstein Perella. Through a series of large-scale acquisitions, he transformed Aetna into the largest healthcare company in the United States, with over 21 million customers. Every one of these transactions was supported by Uber's board. While he was still CEO, he talked to me about with great enthusiasm about a vision of linking patients and doctors through the internet, through e-health business that was revolutionary in its broadness of scope. Not only would health costs be reduced and convenience enhanced, not only would patients benefit and Aetna profit as a company, but Uber envisioned Aetna's using its vast reservoir of medical knowledge to enable patients to ask their doctors intelligent questions and also to educate physicians about medical breakthroughs that were taking place elsewhere in the United States. Knowledge that Aetna would have because of millions of claims it saw in the web of relationships with doctors and hospitals. "We have the largest healthcare database in the world," said Uber. Using it, we should be able to detect early warning signs, leading indicators, particularly of chronic diseases like asthma and diabetes. We could use information technology to scan for patterns. We could alert individual patients and individual doctors. We elevate the entire healthcare industry with the rich information we have mined. It's the right thing to do, and it's also a great way to retain customers. Uber's vision, which linked healthcare to the internet, had all of the elements that that Stephen Case and a William Ford had in their own dreams for their companies. A business plan that was exciting for the firm and its shareholders, but also one that would transform in a positive way the interaction of the company and the broader population which depended on it. It seemed to have ideas way before the competition, at least before anyone else had implemented them. He had the corporate apparatus, including the links to healthcare recipients and providers. So what happened? The problem was in the execution. It wasn't as if Uber didn't know what in theory had to be done or the difficulties in making it happen. The technology is there already, he told me. But making the conversion from our current systems, that's the big deal. There's only one way to do it, fast. Because whoever does it will have first mover advantage. And in this world, that counts for an awful lot. We are very well positioned to be that company, said Huber. But it turned out that Aetna was also preoccupied with digesting the huge acquisitions it had made when it acquired U.S. Healthcare and Prudential Healthcare to reach the critical scale. The obstacles of post-merger consolidation, combined with the pressures to run business in the face of all the ongoing changes in healthcare, Aetna proved too much for Uber to orchestrate all at once. The price of the company stock plummeted, and Uber was unfortunately forced to resign.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC. But it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, by Jeffrey E. Garton. And we're continuing with the chapter, A Vision Without Execution is an Hallucination. Richard Thoman was president and CEO of Xerox and on the road to being chairman when he resigned under broad pressure in May 2000. It would be hard to identify someone better trained to run a global company. With degrees in economics from the finest Swiss universities, plus a PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, Thoman had held senior positions at American Express, RJR Nabisco, and had been chief financial officer at IBM. In June 1999, he presented the compelling pressure to me of the need to thrust an old line company that had made copying machines into a new economy. He talked about the critical importance of not just of generating information, but also of sorting the information, transferring it, and preserving it. I believe that knowledge is the most critical business asset, he said. And the striking thing is that the other half of it is in people's heads. So when they walk out the door, the knowledge goes with them, unfortunately. Companies spend billions of dollars on technology and have given little organized thought to where the knowledge resides, how to share it, how to keep it when people leave. We intend to be in the middle of the revolution to enhance the use and retention of knowledge. To hear him talk, Xerox would become an icon of the new economy with new generations of high-powered digital copying and printing machines, and take its place alongside Intel and Microsoft and Dell Computer as a company that would help define today's information revolution. However, Thoman also ran into execution difficulties. It wasn't that he didn't move fast or aggressively enough. Indeed, he reduced costs quickly, slimming the payrolls by 14,000 people in 2 years. He radically reorganized the sales force to focus on providing upgraded services. He realigned the organization from one based on geography to one based on large customers. He concluded alliances with Sharp, Fuji Photofilm, and Microsoft. Commenting on Thoman's departure, Paul Allier, Xerox chairman, said that he had fully endorsed Thoman's strategy, which he and senior management were all partners in developing. The reason for the ouster? We haven't implemented strategies as well as we should have, said Allier. In late August 2000, Rebecca Mark resigned from Azurix Corporation, a company that was set up to win large concessions to manage and operate water and wastewater assets as the industry was privatized, particularly in developing countries. Azurix was formed in June 1998 and went public a year later. Enron Corporation, the principal shareholder, controlled the board. Mark had come from Enron, where she had risen to vice chairman and become one of the most visible female executives in the global arena. The story is also one of vision that couldn't be executed. Just a year before she resigned, I interviewed Mark in the coffee shop of the Four Seasons Hotel in Washington, D.C., where she was attending a conference. She described a super ambitious game plan. Azurix would take on worldwide water industry, a market estimated in the media to be on the order of $400 billion, in the same way Enron achieved such success in the global energy sphere, she said. Many of the same elements were present, pressures from government to attract private capital to develop the natural resource, increasing customer and industrial demand because of population pressures and urbanization, the need for export management, and so on and so on. In addition, Mark was intent on using the internet to quickly create a market for water equipment and technical training and information for managers. In order to create new billing systems and to organize procurement on international bases, I think we can create a new way of thinking about water and running the water industry, she told me. The greatest problem right now in the industry is that it has a very low sophistication and high degree of fragmentation. So I think we can modernize it within a very short period of time. It was a big idea, but it built on Mark's substantial knowledge and experience in overseas markets. Nevertheless, political problems with deregulation in developing countries delayed projects. Some key executives left, and the stock dropped almost 45% in the first 8 months of the year 2000. Analysts said Azurix's chief problem from the onset was its over-promising of future results, wrote Hillary Durgin and David Owen of the Financial Times. Azurix may have overestimated its ability to compete in a business that has been dominated by old competitors, is rife with political sensitivities, and requires not only huge amounts of capital, but a long-term horizon in order to turn a profit. Compared to other projects in which Enron had invested, The financial return on Azurix was unacceptable to Kenneth Lay, Enron's chairman, and the person who wielded the most influence over Azurix's fate. A lot of capital has been chewed up, he told the Wall Street Journal on the day Mark resigned. I think it's best for Rebecca to start afresh. What are the lessons of the Uber, Thoman, Mark situations? In all cases, the vision was a far-reaching one, but only half of the equation. In Uber's case, the major talent may have been in reorienting the company and expanding it primarily by acquisition, as opposed to the roll-up-the-sleeves management. One of Uber's mistakes was to allow himself to be chairman, president, and CEO, rather than to build a broader top management team to implement his vision. Uber was also the victim of circumstances beyond his control. Political and social forces, which were changing the way healthcare itself needed to be delivered. Thoman's situation illustrates something else. The dilemma of speed versus impact. For all the talk about having to make changes quickly, it is wise to remember that change ultimately entails human behavior. Thoman went for the 100% solution. Do it now, do it quickly, do it thoroughly, and get it behind you as soon as possible. Was there an 80% solution? For example, taking it a little slower, allow a little more slack, don't strip the gears? Maybe, but Thoman was facing huge expectations on the part of investors. He was facing stepped-up competition from Canon and Hewlett Packard. Wall Street had expectations of a swift turnaround. Until the last minute, Thoman was supported by the board. It may have been, as in Uber's case, that given the information available at the time, together with the broader forces at play, stumbling was inevitable, and a better strategy was recognizable only in hindsight. Shortly after Thoman's departure, he admitted that although he had pushed through a massive reorganization a year earlier than he planned, the morale of the organization had been destroyed. I clearly did not get enough Xerox people to understand it was going to work the way they wanted, he told Pamela Moore of Business Week. You could argue that I was tone deaf to the degree around people's concerns, simply because I was worried that if we slowed down, we would never get there. I felt that we did not have the luxury of changing over a five-year period.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Thank you. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Radio. It's Burnaby. Bum, 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 bum.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints on this week's show. Montreal tenants march against rent increase changes proposed by the province's CAC government.
Demandez un logement.
C'est vrai.
Aidez un logement social.
C'est vrai.
The city of Kingston breaks ground on Canada's first ever digital air traffic facility.
We'll be bringing in state-of-the-art cameras, equipment that will, and high-speed networks that will bring in a video feed and simulate the out-the-window view onto a screen that can be independent of the location.